Welcome to the Game Changers podcast, where we have clinical conversations that impact your pharmacy practice. Let's listen in as our team discusses this week's clinical practice game changer.
Hello and welcome to Game Changers Clinical Conversations. I'm your host, Jeff Wall. I'm a professor of pharmacy practice at Drake University and internal medicine clinical pharmacist at Iowa Methodist Medical Center here in Des Moines, Iowa. So today we are going to talk about something new, but something old as well, and that is digoxin. Yes, digoxin has been around for a long, 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 long time. In fact, it's one of the earliest drugs in the pharmacopoeia. But I personally, and I've talked to colleagues of mine around the country, have seen kind of a stupefying comeback or increase in the use of digoxin. And so that coupled with a new meta-analysis that just came out looking at digoxin, I kind of thought maybe it'd be time to talk a little bit about why the comeback. I mean, we digoxin had been real popular in the 70s, 80s, and maybe even early 90s, and then its use really kind of fell off the map. And it's, if you look at the latest guidelines for heart failure from the American College of Cardiology, they don't even really hardly talk about digoxin. So, and it's certainly not a part of goal-directed therapy. So why have we seen such a comeback of it? So, DIG, of course, is an incredibly old drug. It's one that I think most pharmacists remember, from if they ever took a pharmacognosy or weeds and seeds class. I certainly did back in the day, that it came from the foxglove plant. It's been used for about 450 years. And in fact, it's some of the earliest a reported use of it to come back from the 17th century. In particular, a guy named Nicholas Culpepper was probably the first person in writing to talk about the medical uses of the foxglove plant. Now, my guess is it's been used for many years before that, but that was the first written publication with it. And then over the years, of course, more and more physicians, especially in Britain, had started to use it. In particular, they used it for dropsy, which was the old term for pulmonary edema. Again, in most cases, probably associated with heart failure. But other people had noticed that it slows the heart down as well. And in late 19th and early 20th century, when atrial fibrillation was basically described for the first time, there was a physician named Sir James McKenzie, who then said, hey, we know digitalis decreases heart rate. Is there a possibility that perhaps we could use it for this indication? The actual drug digoxin, if you don't talk about, using just basically scraping stuff off the fox leaf plant, was actually isolated by a guy named Dr. Sidney Smith in 1930. And he used something called the Keller reaction to basically derive pure digoxin from the foxglove plant. Then started to get used very commonly, really from the 1950s to the 1990s for both heart failure and atrial fibrillation. And the reason for that, of course, is that it's unique among all the drugs really in the pharmacopoeia that are cardiovascular in nature, and that it is a positive inotrope. It increases contractility of the heart, but it's a negative chronotrope. It decreases the heart rate. And really, that's the only positive chronotrope we've ever had that does that. They've, over the years, they've tried to come up with other positive inotropes for the treatment of heart failure, making sense, kind of increase the contractility. But every other time we've tried to do that, it also increases heart rate and has led to bad outcomes. And so I think it's one of the reasons why digoxin has kind of stayed, at least on the pharmacopoeia someplace and hasn't completely vanished from the earth, in that it increases contractility but decreases heart rate. Like all old drugs, there was very little hard evidence, good randomized control trials that suggested its benefit. And then in the 1990s, probably the best study that was done, or maybe ever will be done, though I hope that's not true, was called the unimaginatively named DIG study. And this was the largest study ever done with digoxin and heart failure, and basically found that it did improve symptoms. And it did decrease hospitalizations, but the original analysis didn't find a difference in mortality. They found that it didn't improve or worsen mortality. A post hoc analysis that was published a couple of years later, in fact, did find that digoxin had an increased mortality in heart failure, especially if serum levels were high. And that's the other piece with serum levels, is that you know, in most hospitals, the reference level for digoxin levels is 1-2. And the original post-hoc analysis of the DITCH study found that, in fact, levels above 1.2 were associated with increased mortality, and levels from 0.8 to 1.2 actually were mortality neutral. Atrial fibrillation, we haven't seen an as big a study done as in heart failure, but several meta-analyses and retrospective studies have found, as far as the mortality piece, pretty much the same thing, that atrial fibrillation, as levels exceed 1.2, 1.3, also has an increase in mortality. Also, you know, remembering that digoxin works as its negative chronotropic effects are actually mediated because it increases the parasympathetic nervous system. One of the things that it makes it not a great drug for rate control in atrial fib is the fact that, you know, it's parasympathetic mechanism. So, you know, yes, if you're just laying there on the couch watching television, it'll keep your heart rate under control. But if you go to shovel snow or exercise or anything along those lines, you're activating the sympathetic nervous system, and that is always going to overwhelm the parasympathetic nervous system, and people's heart rate goes right up. So it's very, very rare to see anybody on digoxin alone for rate control, because by itself it just doesn't do a very good job. I have seen a big uptick, especially in my hospital, where my cardiologists are using DIG loading doses, so kind of the classic 0.5 milligrams times one, and then 0.25 milligrams times two at 6 hour intervals afterwards, to get acute control of heart rate in acute atrial fibrillation in the hospital. Again, to my knowledge, the evidence on that has never been very good. And where I get kind of dismayed in its use, particularly as patients with septic shock on pressors, again, these patients are getting this huge adrenergic surge. And so it's probably unlikely that loading these patients with a parasympathetic drug is really going to do anything. So, you know, that's kind of the background of atrial fib and heart failure with digoxin. Now, serum levels of digoxin have always been somewhat controversial. If you've ever read the classic book, The House of God, which is, I think, almost required reading for anybody entering medical school, a book about basically an intern basically surviving their residency at Massachusetts General Hospital. In the 1970s, one of the attending physicians' characters in that book says, "I don't give a damn what his digoxin level is." And that was kind of the, I think, prevailing thought among cardiologists throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s is, you know, yeah, you can get levels if you want to, but they don't really mean anything, so I'm not going to do anything about them. And I would argue that you know, since the DIG study has been published, and since other studies have suggested this increased mortality with high serum levels or higher serum levels, that serum levels, in fact, really do matter. And I think if you read people who are actually using digoxin in a thoughtful manner, primarily several cardiology pharmacists that I either have talked to or have read some of their stuff on, they note that they're actually very aggressive about monitoring serum digoxin levels. And one of the problems that you run into, as I said, is that traditionally in most hospitals, the serum levels referenced are 1-2. And again, that's wrong. We really should not be targeting levels above 1.2. And then some people even say one. They should really be targeting levels kind of in the 0.5 to 1 or 0.5 to 1.2 range. And so it's going to take some education when, you know, when someone gets a DIG level and it isn't marked red in your electronic medical record that tells you there's something wrong, they're likely to just leave it. And I think that we need to do education on both sides of the fence. We need to talk to our lab colleagues and say, look, we need to change the reference range. Though my attempt to do that in my hospital has largely failed, because even though I show them the studies, they say, well, that's not what our reference textbooks say, so we're just going to leave it the way it is. And I don't know if any listeners out there have had more success than I have done that, but even if you can't do that, talking to the prescribers who use this medication and say, yes, I know it didn't turn red in the results, but we really need to adjust this. And again, that's because of this growing body of literature that suggests that higher serum levels are associated with increased mortality. So Again, I've seen, you know, a kind of a semi-inexplicable rise of digoxin, primarily for atrial fibrillation, but also in some cases now for heart failure. And I know that some cardiology experts have advocated that, you know, if we're using other medications whose primary role it is to decrease hospitalizations and improve symptoms, why don't we do that for digoxin? And I get that argument, you know, that you know, we use a lot of other medications, primarily things like the neurocorticoid receptor antagonist, and really even Entresto has most of its data in decreasing hospitalizations. Yes, it may have some role in decreasing mortality. The SGLT2 drugs are kind of the same way. Their primary outcome, if you look at the big studies, has yes, there's some decrease in cardiovascular mortality, but the prime mover with those studies has been largely improving symptoms and decreasing hospitalizations for heart failure. So I do get that line of theory. I think the only real big difference there is that we have large randomized controlled trials that show us that, and we just really don't have that with DIG, especially in the modern era. I mean, the DIG study was done in the early 1990s, where yes, ACE inhibitors were primarily used, but even then beta blockers were just starting to be used for heart failure. Mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists weren't used at all. And of course, you know, the neprilysin drugs and the SGLT2 drugs weren't even invented yet. So, you know, I think, you know, because of the rapidly shifting landscape, it's hard to say, well, hey, you know, we're just going to use a study from the 1990s to kind of figure that out. So the other reason this really kind of triggered me wanting to do a pod on this was the fact that, yeah, just recently, there was a fairly nice meta-analysis that was done taking a look at this, and it was a systematic review, you know, that again, I think, you know, people are, and you see these meta-analyses every so often trying to say, okay, you know, can we really put these small older studies together and try and figure out, you know, it, you know, what the overall benefit of digoxin and what the harm is. So in this meta-analysis, and we've got a link to the study in our show notes, they looked at patients with heart failure who did receive digoxin. It wasn't just randomized control studies. They also looked at retrospective studies, and they wanted to focus on HFrEF, which makes sense. I don't think anyone ever thought that this drug would work for HFpEF, because decreased cardiac output is not the problem in those patients, right? So it's patients who really have, you know, primary pump failure that you would think a positive inotrope would help with. So they looked again at a number of studies. I think they went back to the early 70s. So again, even some old studies that had looked at digoxin. They initially looked at 397 articles after initial search. Then after removing duplicates and, you know, reaching consensus about what the screening was, they finally ended up with 11 studies that met eligibility for being in the meta-analysis. And they use the standard PRISMA design to make sure it's done, and looking at that. So the study itself looked at, again, there was three randomized control studies. That rest was retrospective studies. And again, going way, way back to the 1980s. So again, you have to kind of keep that in mind. But they wanted to look at all-cause cardiovascular mortality in heart failure. And they basically found that actually digoxin was associated in these studies, when they pulled everything together, with an increase of mortality in the overall population, with a hazard ratio of 1.19, and that was statistically significant. The heterogeneity was pretty high, as you might imagine, because you're talking about studies kind of both prospective and retrospective from the 1980s to the early 2000s, you know, kind of all along the line there. So the I2 statistic was 75%, so kind of keep that in mind, but they rated it using the grade criteria as moderate certainty of evidence. And then they wanted to look at, as a lot of patients or heart failure also have atrial fibrillation. So they did a subgroup analysis in patients who have the combination of heart failure and atrial fibrillation. I think largely because if there were to be a benefit with digoxin, it would be, you know, you're kind of treating two birds with one stone. If they have atrial fibrillation and HFrEF, that they might be able to affect things there. So that made sense to me. Only 8 studies out of the 11 they originally looked at had any data at all in patients with the combination of heart failure and atrial fibrillation. And they found that again, digoxin was associated with an increase in mortality in the patients with combined atrial fibrillation and heart failure, with a hazard ratio of 1.23 and was statistically significant. Again, very high heterogeneity, 70%. But again, this was a low certainty of evidence just because of the decreased number of people. So, you know, bottom line was that all cardiovascular mortality and all cause mortality, when they broke it down, showed an increase in mortality. Now, one of the arguments, as I've said, is that this study, none of these studies, or very few of these studies, actually looked at serum levels and correlated them with these outcomes. And other than the DIDGE study, to my knowledge, none have done that. And so the authors of the meta-analysis note that may be the main player here, and it may be the main driver in whether digoxin, you know, actually has any positive benefit, or is at least mortality neutral if it improves symptoms and decreases hospitalization. If we could get to a point where we could identify patients that digoxin is mortality neutral and you can keep serum levels at, you know, kind of 0.5 to 1, that it might actually have a role. But the bottom line was they couldn't show that in this meta-analysis. And so their thoughts were that at this point, digoxin probably should not be used in most patients with HFrEF with or without atrial fibrillation because of the outcomes that they found. So what does this all mean to the practitioner today? And what's kind of my take on that? We're going to talk about that after a message from our sponsor, CE Impact.
Are you a pharmacist by design? Since we hold a vital position on the healthcare team, it is our responsibility to advance our knowledge and skills so we can provide the best possible care to our patients. Being a pharmacist by design means striving to be the best version of ourselves, not just as professionals, but as individuals dedicated to improving patient outcomes. Learn more about Pharmacist by Design at ceimpact.com. Join us and begin your journey to being the best version of your pharmacist self.
So we are talking about digoxin, the comeback. Whether it's a deserved comeback or not, I guess is my question, because this meta-analysis that we just discussed, and this isn't the only meta-analysis in the last 10 years that's been done, basically show the same thing, that digoxin in general is associated with an increased risk of mortality and atrial fib and heart failure. Now, it is worth noting that there's a lot of experts in the field who have largely, I wouldn't say dismissed, but have suggested that perhaps we shouldn't put a lot of faith in especially retrospective studies that have shown this. In particular, John Mertola, who's a cardiologist, and if you are on social media, the guy is a very prolific social media guy, you know, and he's, you know, I don't know if you call him an influencer, but you know, he's certainly well known in the world of cardiology. He's also, you know, what I would call a maverick. He's one of those contrarian clinicians who, you know, I think, you know, in many cases, quite rightly, wants to look at dogmas and make sure that you know what evidence supports the dogma. That being said, I think my personal opinion is he kind of went off the deep end during COVID because he's a noted anti-vaccine and anti-masking guy, and he's been very clear about that, I think, in his social media. So, I mean, again, that kind of made any respect I had for the guy kind of go out the window. But he has largely advocated for the use of digoxin, and who knows, maybe that's one of the reasons why a lot of cardiologists who you know listen to this guy think, yeah, hey, this is a good idea. He notes that observational studies, by their very definition, may have biases that we can't account for, and that, you know, digoxin has a track record of 400 years of being safe, you know, or being used anyway for heart failure. He notes that a lot of the studies that were done, even though they were done before the modern era, you know, again, were observational studies and may have bias associated with them. And his personal opinion is that, you know, he feels that, you know, his personal practice has that it does improve symptoms and people feel better when they take it. I get that point. I get, you know, I mean, you know, we have drugs that have been in the pharmacopoeia for, you know, decades or centuries that have not really, you know, undergone rigorous randomized control studies, you know, other drugs like colchicine, which until recently had no randomized control studies and now only has one small one to support its use. Nitroglycerin has been used for hundreds of years for chest pain. There are, to my knowledge, no randomized control studies suggest, you know, looking at mortality with nitroglycerin. So, you know, I get that argument, but considering that the evidence that we have does show an increase in mortality, and given that we have no evidence at all in the modern era with goal-directed therapy with the neprilysin inhibitors and with the SGLT2 drugs, I would argue that we really need to do a large RCT with patients on modern goal-directed therapy. And then if they need extra digoxin or they need digoxin for symptoms or for heart failure, that is what actually needs to be done. Now, the drug, of course, has long been generic. It would have to take something like the VA system, and as we've noted on this pod several times in the last couple of years, the VA system, I think, is doing a good job of trying to answer a lot of these, you know, clinical conundrums using medications that are largely generic, so they'll never be sponsored by a drug company, and they're using this very pragmatic design to try and answer these questions, where you know they don't force a placebo and a active control and try to, you know, deploy that in VA centers. They basically utilize a pragmatic system where they have patients on standard of care, and then they ask, not tell, physicians and appropriate patients to utilize whatever therapy they're using. So, you know, if anyone high up in the VA is listening, that would be nice. I think this really needs to be answered, because I think if we're going to see the rise in digoxin use, I think we need to have some evidence looking whether it's beneficial or not. I've certainly seen my fair share of weirdo side effects with digoxin. Of course, you know, bradycardia is the big one. Almost everybody who's on digoxin at a decent dose is going to develop a PR prolongation and at least first degree heart block. That fortunately is not usually harmful in patients, but you can get significant bradycardia and more advanced heart block, which can be life-threatening. It also, of course, increases potassium. And then some other common side effects, you know, I'm sure every pharmacy student in the universe is taught about the blue-green halo effect when they, you know, in visual disturbances. Though I've been a pharmacist for 30 years and never had anybody complain of that. But other common side effects, anorexia and confusion in the elderly, and many others as well. Plus, it's a very dirty drug from a drug interaction perspective. It has many interactions because it goes through primarily the G-glycoprotein pathway, but it also has some cytochrome P450 actions as well. I think the drug that it probably most notably you need to watch out for is amiodarone, because again, if you're using it in atrial fibrillation, a lot of these patients may have background amiodarone, or you may be seeing amiodarone started on patients on digoxin. And as I understand it, certainly this is what I've done for many years, is in someone's on digoxin and you start amiodarone, yeah, you can pretty much expect a 50% or more increase in their serum level. And so you're going to want to back off by about 50% on the digoxin dose kind of empirically in these patients. Are there any other tips and tricks to monitoring these patients? I would say that if you're going to start digoxin for maintenance of atrial fib and heart failure, and again, I'm not suggesting that you do that, but you know, if you start it, or you inherit a patient who's been on this, I think that at first you want to go ahead and just get a serum level at first, and kind of a baseline once they're at steady state. Remember that ditch has a very long half-life, so getting a drug level the day after you start digoxin isn't going to tell you anything. So you really want to get a baseline after about a week, and that's in patients with normal renal function. Because digoxin is at least partially cleared renally, you may have to go longer than that in patients with some degree of renal insufficiency. And then you want to make sure, again, most experts are saying, you know, somewhere between kind of 0.5 and 1 or 0.5 and 1.2, basically. If they develop worsening chronic kidney disease, or certainly in the setting of a patient who's admitted with acute kidney injury, you're going to want to repeat another serum drug concentration. Or if they get started with medications that you know may interact, or if they just start developing signs and symptoms that may represent toxicity, such as bradycardia and hyperkalemia, both of which are related to serum drug levels. So if you have someone whose heart rate's in the 40s and their serum level is 1.4, you very well may be able to continue the drug. Again, I'm not necessarily suggesting you should, but if you wanted to continue the drug, you could basically, you know, adjust the dose down and go from there. The other problem, of course, is that, you know, remember that DIG only comes as two dosage forms, really, when you're talking about the tablets, and that's 0.125 and 0.25 milligram tablets. And so, you know, doing fancy pharmacokinetics, you know, never made any sense to me in a drug that always only comes in two dosage forms. So you're really just going to have to kind of, you know, do your best and, you know, cut the dose in half. You know, if they're at steady state, if you're trying to do that, or, you know, in some cases, I'll even recommend dosing the drug every two or three times a week instead of every day. If you've got a patient who you absolutely insist on using Digoxin for, and their renal function is not good, you may well just have to dose it a couple of times or three times a week. So again, for the third or fourth time, I am certainly not advocating the use of this, but for better or worse, I'm seeing in particular some cardiologists who've decided to kind of pick up the Digoxin ball again and start using it in heart failure and in some cases atrial fib. If you can't, if that is the way we're going to go with the use of this medication, I think we owe it to patients to really not ignore ignore the house of God and really take a look at monitoring these patients closely, including serum drug levels. So that's it for this week of Game Changers. Again, thanks for listening. We will see you next week, but until then, remember, time flies. I don't know where it's going, but the most important day is today. We'll see you next time.
Jen here. Be sure to check out our education at ceimpact.com. You'll find it to be your one-stop shop for all the CE resources you need. Become a Pharmacist by Design member today to access it all for free, including CE for this podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week on Game Changers Clinical Conversations.